There came a rap on the stable door. "Arrow, could you possibly get some balloons for the leap year party?" Matt asked. "It'd be a huge help." And Arrow agreed. It would be good to get out and stretch your legs anyhow. After the ice storm and persistent snow blanketed the town and studio, the chances to really get out and trot had been really hard to come by. Arrow was in a fine mood, better than fine, and she was going to get the finest balloons possible for that leap year celebration. The best balloons in town were sold at a little shop owned and operated by 20 little ratite birds. They were top quality, stayed inflated for a long time, and they were filled with a lighter-than-air, renewable balloon sauce. It was almost the end of the month, she figured. She may as well just get some premium inflated balloons and do a knockout job. Arrow began to trot up the boulevard, a fanciful promenade of pride and distinction. Trotting across the cobbles up a staircase, a porcupine suddenly apparated in thin air, and its quills instantly ruptured the balloons. "Dearly sorry, my good horse." He tipped his hat and scurried off. So, Arrow returned to the shop. The Kiwis gave her a deal on some super resilient balloons. They could take at least 4 punctures before rupturing. She thanked him and began making her way back to the studio. Arrow made it all the way back to the studio where she noticed a large crate. Looking at the waybill, it read from the Empire State Building, care of El Viento. As the lid flew off, a cloud of thousands of bats issued forth. These bats were curiously carrying stalactites, which their little bat footsies couldn't hold for long. Taking cover under her extra-strong balloons, Arrow survived the incident, but the party favors did not. Once more back to the store, Arrow bought several cast-iron balloons. These were impervious. She could barely move, but at least they wouldn't bust. The bats bounced off of them. A porcupine appeared once more, but was completely ineffectual. This was it, finally. Nearing the studio once more, a small extraterrestrial in a little saucer appeared. "Arrow," it said. "Yes?" "You haven't been to space in a very long time. Are you forgetting about your contracts?" "Well, it would accept no excuses. A powerful laser shot forward and vaporized the cast iron balloons. Arrow was, to say the least, a little miffed as the saucer flew off. This time Arrow had had enough. She went to the local dollar store, bought a baggie of 30 vinyl balloons, the kind that taste really bad when you hold them to your lips, took them home and threw them at Matt. "There's your frickin' balloons. You can blow them up your own damn self." "Thanks, Arrow. Leap day isn't for 2 years, so I'll probably have an air pump by then anyhow." So, this is the Arrowcast for February 2022. We're going to talk about the New Zealand story. But before we get into that, Chris, how has your February been?
Yeah, February's been all right. In terms of stuff I did this month, start things off, I cleared Rockman World 5, also known as Mega Man 5 on the Game Boy. I think last I left off, I was up to the last set of stages. I had just finished up all the Robot Masters. So immediately after doing that, there was a bit of a small shoot-'em-up section. And for some reason, I absolutely despise the shoot-'em-up section so much that my opinion of the game just sunk then. But then it went back up after I did the rest of the game. So in the end, other than some things I was still not too impressed by, which was like that shoot-'em-up stage, and there was too many other systems there, like the P-point things that you have to collect as kind of a currency. I don't know. I just found that a little too excessive. But I still like the idea of the different Robot Masters. And the levels are pretty interesting in the end. So there were some things I didn't like. But overall, I would say, you know, I was in favor of it. I can't rank them efficiently now because I really don't remember my opinions of 2, 3, and 4. I just don't remember 1 was a little too clunky for me. And I mean, it's the first Game Boy game, so they were still learning things. But I'd have to, like, listen back to my previous podcast and what I said about them. But yeah, overall, 5 was okay. Yeah, but in the end, I think by the time they did their last classic Mega Man game for the Game Boy, I think they got a lot of stuff together. It just didn't quite hit all the points for me, but it was still overall good. So, clearing that, I got to my main goal, which was to play Rockman and Forte on the Wonder Swan. And I guess I have to say, thirst can only get me so far, because I played Forte's route, because of course I had to play him first, and I had only played the prologue and one of the stages, which was a Conroe Man. And I can't blame the Wonder Swan sometimes, but I think it was a really limited system, and those two stages alone felt really boring to me, and maybe it's just playing as Forte with his playstyle of shooting multiple bullets at once instead of a charge. It's just, I don't know, not very fun for that game, or at least the two stages I cleared with it. So I want to say I dropped it for now, unless I get really curious and maybe develop a little more tolerance for it, but
That's too bad.
yeah. Can't recommend the Wonderswan game right now.
Well, Rock always had the better gameplay, so it might be better on his path. You might just want to try that.
It might be possibly. I don't know. The concept is charming, though. I like the very unique robot master that showed up in this game. But,
Just having fun.
you know, can't do it right now. I can't. But other than that, I think I sort of mentioned this at the during the final thoughts of the Zork podcast, where it kind of reignited my interest in interactive fiction. So, pretty much after we recorded that, I was on interactive fiction database, and I was just kind of going through a couple of short games in my spare time. So I definitely got to experience a variety of them. Some of them were a lot more puzzle based, and then a lot of them are more modern, so you can do a lot more things like free poetry in a sense, or more artsy feels journey. So it's just really interesting to see how the genre has come along so far. And I think I had a really good time just finding all my different options. Some of them I wasn't too odd about, but that was the point. I was just trying to explore about what was going on nowadays.
So are they indie games or?
I think for the most part they are indie games, so that's neat. Like, I can't blame people for like if it's something that's not too elaborate, but with
Yeah.
the limited process of interactive fiction, but at the same time of how far things have gone, I mean, it's really neat just to see how everyone's interpretation of exploring a story is.
There are form tools to make that though, right?
Yeah, definitely. Like, a lot of them are just hosted on browsers now, and you can just easily save your progress and so on. Yeah, but that's about my February. What's been going on with you, Matt? Any golf you want to not talk about?
No, I won't talk too much about it, but it ties into Dark Cloud 2, which I had started on the last podcast. I think I'd only played a few sessions of it at that time, but I finished it now, insofar as I've beaten the extra chapter at the end. It's a beast of a game. It's not quite as long as Dark Cloud 1, and I think that's because there's only the two playable characters, although they both have transformations that you can put time into as well. But rather than having a bunch of characters, each with individual weapon lines to go down to, and having a much more streamlined weapon synthesis system, it's easier to build that stuff up than it was in Dark Cloud. So I think the dungeons are simplified and the weapon synthesis streamlined. I think Dark Cloud 2 is probably a much more accessible game for newcomers, but it's a good game. It's a lot more story heavy than Dark Cloud 1. And I think that's because it's got two characters it can focus on, so it can actually tell their story, and it's got voice acting this time instead of just the text of Dark Cloud. Like, Dark Cloud has some characters that are introduced, and then they almost never appear again after their chapter is over. So it's, and I mean playable characters, they don't have any story relevance once their particular chapter is over. So I think they went through some motions to rectify that for Dark Cloud 2. And it's unfortunate there'll probably never be a Dark Cloud 3, but I think that probably would have been the next evolution of this. That Rogue Galaxy was actually supposed to be Dark Cloud 3, but it obviously turned out a lot different than that would have been. But anyhow, it was a good game. I enjoyed, again, building the weapons. I enjoyed the dungeons. And it had a lot of mini games that you don't really have to interact with. But I will talk briefly about Sfida, which is the golfing mini game, that every time you beat a dungeon, he says you can play Sfida, and it's basically there's a distortion that you have to knock a ball into or a sphere into, and the distortion can be red or blue, and the ball can be red or blue, and every time you hit the ball against the surface hard enough, it'll change color, and you have to put the opposite color into the distortion. And that makes it sound a lot simpler than it is. Because say you're in the forest, you don't have solid walls, you have a tree line that you can shoot the ball through, so you have to shoot the ball blind through the tree line for half of these shots. And it's like, yeah, if it falls in between the trees, you have to start over. Or when you learn how to play Svita is in a large canyon area, and you have to fucking wallop that ball hard enough that it's going to knock off the canyon walls without falling in the bottomless chasms to get around the cliff face that's between you and the goal that's too high to shoot the ball over. So it's extremely daunting at first, Svita, but once you learn how to put backspin on your clubs and you get a couple different clubs and you kind of learn the sweet spots and you kind of learn, you know, this much power on a medium club will send me this far, and with this much backspin it won't move very far forward, or shoot it this far with some topspin and it'll bounce forward after changing color going to a goal. There's all sorts of different techniques that you pick up over time playing Svita that it actually it goes from being really frustrating to being really fun. And the only biggest issue with it is that you're reliant on the in-dungeon camera, which works great for combat, but for lining up your shots, it's not that great. Especially if you're trying to ricochet the ball into the goal, sometimes you've got the dotted line that'll show the trajectory of your ball, but you can't tell if it's touching the distortion or not. Anyhow, it's probably the most notorious aspect of Dark Cloud 2, and it's really only for medals, which you can trade with the mayor to get cosmetics. Like, you get 60 medals you can buy an outfit for Monaco, or, you know, another 60 you can buy a hairpiece for, or you can buy the clown suit for the clown suit for Max, which is what I use to play Svita now because it's a joke. So it's not a system that you have to interact with. And the same as all of these minigame systems, you don't have to interact with them. They're there if you want to. But if you're really invested in Dark Cloud, you're probably going to interact with them. So it's a frustrating system at times, but it's rewarding if you learn it. And that's the same for all of the mini games in it. But yeah, it was a really good game. I've already talked more than I want to about it, but I'm probably going to write my thoughts down on it in a couple of days, and that'll be a bit more in-depth and structured and coherent.
Do you have a personal preference between one or two?
It's been over 10 years since I played one. I think I enjoyed it more, just for the tone and the character variety, but I'd have to play it again. I think I like the trickier upgrade system better in one. I like that there's more commitment to it, and it's more involved, or at least it's more arcane, right? And I kind of like that more for it. But if I go back and play Dark Cloud 1 now, I don't know what my opinion will be. There's a chance that I'll have gotten used to all the systems in Dark Cloud 2, and I'll prefer that more. But because Dark Cloud 2 is much more character and text-driven than Dark Cloud 1 is, they do present as different games. It's kind of Vagrant Story versus Parasite Eve, which is an extreme example. But Parasite Eve and Vagrant Story use the same kind of limb targeting system. They're kind of built on the same kind of systems, but they have different tone and different execution of it. That's what I would liken it to. Not as severe a difference as that, but it's a similar vibe. Otherwise, just to be a palate cleanser before Elden Ring comes out, I've been playing Record of Lodoss War Delith in Wonder Labyrinth again, since I tried it out a couple months ago, and I played a fair bit of it. It seems like it goes by pretty quick, but I'll have more to say about that next month after I finish it, but the bosses are really good.
It looks pretty good from the screenshots you've been sharing.
Yeah, it's fun. I think the level progression could be a bit more intricate, but it has a lot of cool, pulley-based puzzles where you have to hit gears with your bow, and sometimes there's a magnet that'll warp the trajectory of your arrows, or there's a sandbag that you have to fill with enough arrows that it's weighed down and opens a gate, and yeah, it's fun. It's like hardcore Symphony of the Night love letter. Like, it's really, really aping Symphony of the Night, but it also has sort of Ikaruga vibes, switching between wind and fire, so you can drain the MP of wind and fire attacks to power your arrows and your spells. I've been thinking a bit about it. I'm going to try to get a hold of and watch some Record of Lodoss War, because my familiarity with it is, like, almost nil. It was back in the day, but I think I probably watched more Slayers and Bastards at the time. And then,
well, to be fair, it's Slayers, so.
Yeah, like way back, your first time down the internet anime web turnpike or whatever, but yeah. The New Zealand Story is a 1988 platforming and maze navigation arcade game developed and published by Taito. 21 Kiwis are taken from a zoo in Auckland by a leopard seal, though our hero Tiki squeezes free from his sack and embarks on a journey to rescue his friends. The New Zealand Story takes Tiki across the north and south islands of the country as he chases down the leopard seal who took his friends and his one true love, Fifi. Now, the New Zealand Story does feature locations based on real locations in New Zealand, so I'll apologize for pronunciations ahead of time. I haven't been, but I would love to go to New Zealand. Chris, as always, do you have any experience with the series?
Oh, another podcast. Well, I have a 5-second part. No, I unfortunately do not have any experience with the New Zealand Story or the NES port Kiwi Craze.
As for myself, I'll keep it brief. When the DS came out, Taito, they produced a few, like, Revolution versions of their old arcade games, and New Zealand Story Revolution was one of them. So I probably picked that up for, like, $20 on the DS, just looking for a cheap game to play that might be fun, looked cute, looked fun. I liked it a lot, and I know that purists of the New Zealand Story would probably take umbrage with that. However, it got me interested in the series. I would later pick up Kiwi Craze and also play the arcade game. Now, I forget if that was on Taito Legends or not, because I played a lot of Taito Legends, and I can't remember if it was on there or not, or if I played it through other means at the time. But yeah, I liked the game, and I went ahead and played some of it. So, what is the general gameplay loop of the New Zealand Story?
So the stages progressively get different kinds of gimmicks, but the idea is that you're presented with a relatively large stage where enemies will spawn in. Tiki does not take any damage from bumping against any enemies, but Tiki will instantly die in one hit if he is hit by a projectile of some sort, which the enemies are constantly throwing at you, or if any spiked enemy will touch you, that's a difference. Like, for the first world, we'll get more into detail about it, but it's mostly platforming. Some enemies will occasionally drop, sometimes, items that will upgrade Tiki's projectile that he has. He initially starts with an arrow, but you can get something like a laser gun later, or there's something like a staff that will make you invincible for some time, if I recall correctly.
Right, so the staff in particular is different between the two versions, or between the New Zealand Story Arcade and Kiwi Craze. In Kiwi Craze, as you mentioned, it generates an invincibility effect for Tiki. And in the New Zealand Story, it shoots a large fireball that kind of bounces around. It's another kind of weapon that you can get.
In later stages, I don't think it's much of an issue in World 1, but it becomes in later ones that you need to kind of take their hovering vehicle thing, and you can use that to sort of fly. So you can use that to traverse the stage. And you'll eventually reach your Fifi at the end. It's labeled as exit on the corner of the map, so that's what your direction is. But, of course, the stages might get very big and very maze-like
Yeah. Yeah, even though it shows X's on the map, it gives you a general idea to navigate towards, but sometimes you gotta go around the whole damn thing, right? Or other times there's lots of different ways to get to the X's or to your Kiwi friend. And it becomes a decision of whether or not you want to take the longer way to see if you can guess maybe some letters or whatnot. But the game operates on a timer.
Yes, I forgot to mention the timer system, yes. You never see the clock in the game, so I don't actually know how many seconds or minutes you have within every stage. Maybe it's different depending on the how large the stage is, but eventually, once you see a hurry up being flashing on your screen, that means you really need to get your butt over to Fifi already.
Yeah, and I don't know if it actually resets if you die, because there's been times that I've lost a life and come back, and then all of a sudden it says hurry up right away. So something tells me that the thing that resets the timer is the devil coming to get you. Plus, yeah. So, I mentioned that there's letters to find. That's the extend system. Did you interact much with these letters, or did you just try to get to the exit?
Well, when I started it, I was like, oh, I can probably get a few letters. The extend works if you collect all the letters. It's kind of like Bubble Bobble. You get an extra life. Mm-hmm. These only appear in the arcade version, not the NES title. I think the NES game only has little versions of Tiki you collect, kind of like, you know, one-ups or something.
Yeah. It's a bit easier.
But yeah, for the most part, I think I only got like three letters maybe on a stage. And, but you know, you're so crunched on time, at least I am, because I don't know where to go most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
We'll talk about this more, but I had kind of credit-feeded arcade game and I didn't even clear it. So you know what? Yeah, I didn't bother getting all of extent.
And did you find any warps at all? Because there's a warp system too.
I did find a couple of them. I didn't really do it in the NES version, even though I was surprised that they were relatively in the same place, but mm-hmm. I tried it out, but I wanted to experience the whole game, at least the NES one, because that's the one I cleared the whole way without any jumps.
So the warps are sort of in invisible spots that you have to shoot, and I'll be clear right now, the New Zealand story is a quarter muncher game, so if you know where these hidden warps are and you have to come back to the arcade, say, another time, that can help you get forward in it, I guess. That's a common thing in a lot of old arcade games. Like, a lot of the shoot-em-ups have hidden spots that you can shoot just for, like, points items and things like that. So, yeah, there's a
warp. Well, yeah, a lot of arcade games were, you know, memorization in a way, yeah. So.
Well, and this is a maze game, so once you kind of have an idea of like the path to take, especially like later in the game, if you take the wrong path, you waste a lot of time. So,
or you just jump a little too high.
If you just jump a little too high and you go off to the track that you already went through, but we'll get into that because that's a whole level. But yeah, I guess we'll leave it there and we'll get into the game itself. So there is a progression to the New Zealand story, but a lot of the enemies pretty well occur throughout the entire game. Some are introduced a little bit later. Some are only introduced in the harder versions of the game. We're contending with mostly the same rogues gallery throughout the entire game. So let's talk about the enemies in the game first. Are there any that are particularly memorable or prickish?
Well, I'm glad you brought up the bats from El Viento in the intro, because so many times when I was hovering over somewhere, especially in a tight spot, I was like, oh, look, smooth sailing. And then just conveniently, one of these bats will show up and then just run into me. But that wasn't bad enough, because sometimes I'm just trying to dodge everything else relatively closer to the ground, and then a bat will spawn above me. And it will drop one of those stalactite things. It's like, you know what? Thanks.
Yeah, bats. They're pretty rough on balloons. I think The flying enemy I dislike the most are the pumpkins in the hot air balloons, because they really track you at the top of the screen, and they drop those bombs. They almost like lead their shots, and they are kind of tough to contend with unless you have enough space. Like if you have the duck balloon, you have enough speed to get to the side of them, but they can pretty well track you with most of the other ones, so they can be pretty rough.
I feel like for the most part of the game, after a while, maybe it's because I kind of just slammed through the NES version, all these enemies ended up being pricks at some point, but the initial enemies you fight are become less of a threat. They're like the most easiest ones, probably like the kind of soldier type looking enemies that shoot the arrows. I thought I'd be more concerned of the ones that shoot arrows up, but those are actually surprisingly easy to dodge for me.
It depends if like five of them spawn underneath you or not, because that happens.
Okay, that's another thing. Yeah, okay. This is the game of convenient spawn locations, I'll say that.
Well, I'm pretty sure like the spawn locations for certain rooms are predetermined. I think, they have to be, because if you need a balloon, they have to respawn after a certain amount of time, right? There's definitely a case of enemies spawning on top of you. Like, there's the little orange balls with the spikes, those little guys. I find that they can spawn right on top of you a lot.
Oh, and I don't think I've experienced that in the NES version.
And there's multiple versions of, like, the level sets for the New Zealand story. And we played predominantly the old Japanese version, because that's what most of the ports are based on. But yeah. I also, for my own enjoyment, played World New, which is a harder level set, but there was like this porcupine or hedgehog on a balloon, and that's what I refer to in the intro to this podcast. And that fucker, pardon my language, really like tracks your position and tries to flank you, and he tries to just be right on top of you. And because it's a fairly big spiked hitbox, and it can spawn right on top of you, I died to him a lot. And there's one time where I was in the water trying to come up for air, and he was like going back and forth on top of the surface of the water. So that porcupine is not super common, but it can be a real prick when it shows up.
I also recall having trouble with the frogs, because a lot of frogs will spawn at once, and they all have this little projectile. Ridiculous. I can't believe those cute little frogs could be so menacing. Well, I guess this game is cute things are menacing, is the story of the game.
And you would think the spaceship guys would be more dangerous, but you just get excited that there's a spaceship for you to steal. I don't really care yeah. there, because that's the best vehicle. So it's like, you know.
The duck is pretty cute, though. I also like the duck vehicle, personally.
That is cute, yeah. There's a fair variety of enemies, but they all do sort of different things to the same end. Let's just talk about the balloons and vehicles in this game. Did you have any favorites yourself?
Well, I just mentioned that I like the duck one a lot. I think that's because it looks cute.
And it's fast.
Yeah, and it's fast. I guess if we're going to talk about mechanics really quickly about these vehicles, sometimes they're just a little awkward, but I think they all have their quirks to them. Like, the duck one is fast, but then sometimes trying to lift in one just takes just a frame to load. It's like that precious millisecond that I need to get up. Also, for some reason, I had a lot of trouble dismounting on them sometimes. But I don't know if that was just like fatigue settling in or under pressure because of the timer that I just wasn't really registering. Just hit down on the vehicle when you're on solid ground kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, there's that big balloon with the spike trail behind it. I found when I got on that, it wasn't worth it, because when I dismount, I would die. So, because the tail has its own sort of physics, too, so it can kind of coil underneath the balloon. That's like, not worth it. Some of these balloons you can stick to your head. Some of them you can just, well, the ones that you can stick to your head, you can also jump on top of. And there's advantages to doing that or not, like, if you have it on top of your head, there's less of a chance of you getting hit by an enemy.
And we should mention the prick setup of this game, where if you want to steal something's vehicle, you better make sure you only hit the enemy and not the vehicle itself.
unless they have a multiple hit balloon, or if they have the iron balloon, then... And I think maybe the Zeppelin can take multiple hits as well, but the Zeppelin is the one balloon I barely wanted to use, because it's so big.
Yeah.
Most times you have to give up the balloon really quickly, but there's other times you have to squeeze through a little space with it, so the bigger balloons aren't really worth it. I did like the iron balloon, even though it was slow, because you could touch spikes with it without it popping. So there's some useful locations you can kind of take your hand off the button and just kind of drift across them.
I feel like that's most locations that you can kind of drift if there's spikes in this game. Oh, God, it's a part of the maze.
This game does have a couple of spikes for sure.
It's a prickish game. What am I saying?
I guess so, yeah. I just mentioned the UFOs are the best vehicle. Because they natively just let you press up and down. You don't have to hold a button. And they have a really powerful weapon, either the laser or the homing missiles. I only found the homing missile UFO in one level, but it was fun to use anyhow.
I don't think that's in the NES version, so I don't think I experienced it. And if it was in the arcade version, I probably did not get far enough to see it, or I was just very unlucky with RNG.
You know, you're talking about that you specifically have to destroy the enemies on top of the balloon or underneath the balloon in order to steal their vehicle. I had some issues with certain weapons to do that. So let's just talk about the different weapons in the game. I know we kind of talked about it in the intro, but did you generally prefer to upgrade your weapon when you could, or did you stick with the arrows?
I feel like when I was playing the NES game, my RNG for getting new weapons was very slim. I did not like the bomb, which I know you'll have a lot of words about. So for the most part, I used arrows, but whenever I saw the laser gun, I would like to get that, just because it was a lot faster than the arrows, and it just felt stronger, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
One item I did not like was the book, because that clears out all enemies, and if you need a vehicle, that just really sucks, especially when you feel like that clock is ticking and you really need a vehicle now.
Destroys your vehicle, too, if you're on one.
Yeah, so it's something that is useful in theory, but definitely not in this game.
So, I'm generally the same. I either use the laser or the arrows. The laser, because it's easy to aim it. Even though it can break the tougher balloons as well. I didn't like the bombs. They don't have much range, and it's difficult to defeat an enemy off of its balloon with the bombs, especially if they're staying out of range. You can kind of like jump at an enemy and knock it off the balloon, but it's much more difficult with the bomb. And I found that the fireball is very powerful, but it bounces all over the place, and it's just more trouble than it's worth. So generally, yeah, I either stick with arrows or the laser. But it's time to get into the game, finally. We're going to start in Auckland. Now, how does Auckland introduce you to the mechanics of the New Zealand story? And does this succeed as an introductory level?
Like I was sort of mentioning when we were introducing the game, the gimmicks increasingly ramp up as you go along through the game. But I think the first world is pretty basic and teaches you how the game will pretty much be throughout the whole thing. Like 1-1 is pretty vertical, but it gives you the idea that you shouldn't take your sweet time killing all these enemies. There is a timer in this game. And then I think from 1-2 onward, you learn that you need to take enemies' vehicles, and then it's definitely bigger and a little more vertical, so you understand that you need to go through these maze-like situations.
Yeah. I think this still uses the arrows as well. Like, there's arrows graffitied on lots of walls in this game. Did you find the arrows helpful at all, or did you find that the arrows kind of mislead you?
I actually found the arrows useful for the most part, but maybe I just got lucky with finding one that just led me to an efficient path, even though I definitely ran out of time plenty of times, but I just kind of did that more technical skill of trying to get to Fifi in time rather than trying to find a new path.
Yeah. So I think I kind of agree. It does introduce a lot of the mechanics to you. Like there's water in World 1. There's sections that you have to float around spikes in World 1. And there's the arrows to guide you. There's extend letters to find. There's lots of interesting things to see and kind of introduce you to the game. There's lots of enemies still, so it's not necessarily without its issues, but generally Auckland is a lot lighter than like stage 3 especially onwards. So
yeah,
I think it's a good introductory level. However, curiously, it has maybe the gimmickiest boss in the game is in the first level. What did you think about the whale?
Yeah, I thought the whale was pretty cool as a gimmick, and I'll spoil it now. That kind of got my hopes up for other bosses in the game. It shoots projectiles at you, and the projectiles are very easy to dodge, but you'll notice that your projectile does absolutely no damage. So what needs to happen is that when the whale sinks down, you need to get into its mouth, and then from the inside, you will start shooting it from there and then kill it.
Yeah. And it's interesting because it's like stomach acid is dripping off it, even though its stomach apparently attaches to its blowhole. But, yeah, I think it's a cool boss. And I think it's a very unique way to take this on, especially, like, I mean, there's a boss like this in Yoshi's Island and all that. But, like, this is kind of really cool for the time. If you touch its forehead when it's coming towards you, you'll die. And if you see this whale flying towards you with its mouth open, are you going to let yourself get eaten as the, you know, default response to playing a video game? It's just kind of strange that this one's the first boss, especially when there's no other gimmick bosses in the entire game.
Yeah, but I don't know. It was a fun gimmick. And I only found out about it by accident because I was like, oh no, I dodged too slowly. And then I understood, oh, this is what you need to do. So.
Yeah. I mean, you can definitely just by sheer happenstance find your way into its mouth. It's probably how most people, including myself, originally found their way into this whale. I just think it's funny that that's the gimmick rather than it like sucking you up or something. But yeah, it's definitely a cool boss and definitely a cool gimmick. And as you said, it's unfortunate that the rest of the bosses are maybe played a little too straight. But we'll get to them when we get to them. Definitely a fun time. Now, again, I'm sorry for pronunciations in this game. Stage 2, World 2 is Rotorua. Now, does this level step things up sufficiently?
I think compared to what we just experienced in World 1, like going right into 2-1, the stage is a bit bigger and definitely more maze-like. Although, it doesn't seem maze-like at first, but there are a lot of smaller compartments where you think that it branches off, but even though, like, it tells you where Fifi is, it's still a time process to just figure out jumping all the way over there and so on.
So, one thing that this introduces, not just these multiple paths to the same location, these more, like, microcosm mazes, it's, like, it kind of divides the big level into multiple smaller challenges or multiple smaller levels. But now it adds dirt traps and these sort of alternating paths. How does this impact your timer and your general progression through levels?
Well, you start playing a lot more sloppier because you see these things and you're trying to time it, but you're also remembering the clock is on you, so it gets pretty dicey, but it's not that bad yet.
Oh, yeah, so this is
water
gets really introduced in this level. We didn't really talk about Tiki's swimming capabilities, yes. Let's give us a rundown of how Tiki operates in water.
I didn't want to talk about Tiki's swimming abilities because it's absolutely awful. So if you thought trying to get a vehicle and trying to find your way through this labyrinthine-like stage was enough, and then you're trying to dodge everything else while not getting hit because you pretty much die in one hit, then you get to swim. And when I initially started swimming, because you move so slow, I thought, is there, like, a button that makes you do a little burst of swimming? No, you just swim at that same speed the whole freaking way. And additionally to that, Tiki has an oxygen meter, which is tied to your HP. So, fortunately, there's, like, one little spot where you need to learn that you need to jump up where there is no water to get your air back. But this is going to become a reoccurring problem throughout the game where you see water and you're just like, oh, no.
And you've got those friendly sea anemones in the water as well that can grab you. So
I feel like those are relatively easy to dodge, but just waiting for them to feel their tentacles and then retract them. Oh god, this is like 5 seconds of time that I'm losing right now in this horribly slow water section.
These water stages are where I first, like, ran the timer down in this game. And it wasn't until I played through Kiwi Craze that I realized, I guess, you know, when Tiki is at the surface of the water, he can spit water. I guess that water is actually in his lungs, because if you spit water, it rapidly refills his air meter. And I didn't realize that until I was playing Kiwi Craze. And it makes these sections a little bit faster because you can, you know, spit 5 or 6 times and your air meter is mostly full. But it's kind of grim to think about that. Your
Oh
this poor little kiwi,
my
his lungs are
God.
filled with water and you're spitting it out. It's fucking
Oh.
terrible, but yeah. But if you're just like waiting for your air meter to refill, because your air refills, even when you're out of water and walking around, your air refills slowly. So if you are sitting there waiting for it to refill, that's why the timer was running down on me in this stage. Yeah, the water is rough and it'll get rougher as time goes on, but we'll talk about that. We'll talk about that. So we've reached the second boss. We're going at a pretty good clip now. Talk about this, like, rock octopus.
Yeah, I guess it's a little Octorok like. It is made out of rock. It's got extra legs on the bottom, and it shoots stuff at you. And this is one of the bosses where you're like, okay, sweet, I can just shoot at the boss. There isn't a gimmick. But I guess the gimmick is that it shoots bats at you. And oh my gosh, the bats are, they almost feel like they're homing in on you. So you have to make sure your projectiles hit them all, or you just dodge. But I think dodging is a lot more difficult to do. But I don't know. Go pick your poison. Do you want to try to aim for all the bats at once, or do you want to try dodging them while trying to also aim at the rock octopus?
Yeah, like, I think if the octopus is, like, really high above you, the bats generally aren't an issue, but if it's closer to you, your horizontal plane, it's easier. I kind of stayed on the floor because I found when I tried to stay on the platforms next to the wall, it was a lot easier for me to die. But that's just what I found myself.
Yeah, I think it's just easier to dodge the bats and do whatever you're trying to do, stay alive by being
Yeah.
on the floor.
This also demonstrates how much better having a laser weapon is than arrows in this particular fight, because I
Well, if
think
you die a
because
lot, I mean,
yeah,
huh.
but I mean, if you're lucky enough to get a drop before coming in here, except for the bombs, I would definitely take the drop because, yeah, it's difficult to hit this guy in the lips with those arrows consistently. Like you said, you were mostly flailing at it and you got through, but yeah, it's a pretty standard boss, but those semi-homing bats. Kind of,
Those damn El Viento bats still back
it's
to
just
haunt us.
Elviento bats, yeah. Who would have known that that statue octopus was full of bats made of ink? But yeah, it's a cool concept. But yeah,
I
it's
guess, yeah.
no, I like it. It's a rock octopus with ink bats. It's a pretty high concept. So from level 3 onwards, did you ever get to go to heaven?
Yeah, I only got to try it once. I think it's an interesting concept that if you die, you go through this kind of short, mostly platforming stage, and then to get the end, you are revived to go after Fifi again. But it's a weird thing, but I think it's kind of nice in a way to get a second chance. Unlike Zork, when you get back to life and you have none of your inventory and you're just stuck in a forest somewhere.
So it is very particular. It is very particular. So from World 3 onwards, if Tiki dies with a projectile stuck in his head, and he dies by falling downwards, he will ascend to heaven. I think this can only happen on one continue. Like, in order to do the other heaven loops, I played each heaven level when I went through the world level set, so I had to game over a couple of times in order to have a fresh continue, like a fresh cycle to do it on. They're relatively easy stages. There's enemies and spikes in them, of course, but if
Which
you
is a
touch
weird thing to call it heaven, but I digress.
the yeah, and if you touch the goddess, it's actually kind of grim. It says that, like, Tiki is lulled into a warm, long sleep or something like that.
It's a strange Taito thing. I don't know if this is any other Taito game, because it's certainly interesting.
In order to actually escape from heaven, you have to find, like, invisible blocks to fall through, so you can fall back to Earth. If you die in heaven or touch the goddess, you'll go back to the level you game over on. And if you clear heaven, like find a secret exit out of one of these places, you'll go to the next level. So at the very least, you can progress to the next level. So if you're having a lot of difficulty on one stage, then that's sort of an out for that if you know how to get through heaven. But it's not as simple as just like reaching the goddess.
Yeah.
And you have to die in your last life. It's not like you just die that certain way once. It has to be your last life. So it's a pretty arcane system. But it's really cool that it's in the game. Yeah, I think it's cool.
Cool. I think it's weird, but definitely interesting. Weird and interesting.
Weird and interesting, yeah. Cool and unusual.
Yeah, okay, that one's good too.
So the next level, Waitomo Caves. Now this is largely a combination of like long shafts and water segments. There's some mazes mix it in. It's basically a harder version of Rotorua.
I don't know, I just feel like any of my real grievances with this game are just, you know, it's just a calm before the storm right now in World 3.
Right. I'm looking at some of the maps now. They're pretty, like, circuitous. You have to go, like, in these big arcs around the map. There's some really long water levels. I think the main issue at level 3 is probably the timer.
Yeah, I think maybe the... I'm going to call it a gimmick of World 3, is that it just becomes really labyrinthine at this point.
The level I kind of really want to talk about is 3-4, because this is the one that has, like, there's waterfalls all throughout World 3, and they kind of push you down into water. You can't move through them. And the top of World 3-4, there's a series of waterfalls that you kind of have to navigate. I found that was really tripping me up somehow. Like, I'm not sure why, but it was really messing with my head. Like, there's arrows that go every which way in this stage, and they're pointing down into this water, or back through this waterfall, or up this way. And really, what you have to do is go up and right with a balloon at a certain point, and just never mind the waterfalls. You have to get to the right of all of the waterfalls and then get yourself a ride.
I think I just got fortunate that I had fallen through the rightmost waterfall, and then when I tried to get a way back, I landed in the boss room. I mean, looking at the map now, I feel like if you had progressed more, then you would have been really stuck in this one particular area, because it's pretty tight if you go through the leftmost one.
I don't know why this one confused me, but the boss is a like iron idol kind of thing that shoots missiles. Let's talk about this boss.
This one isn't as cute as the whale, because they're all not as cute as the whale, I guess. But sure. This is similar in a way to the rock octopus we just fought, where it is a boss that kind of just floats around and shoots projectiles at you. But this time, instead of bats, it shoots bullets, which are set in a V formation and then spread out as they get farther away from the boss where it was shot at. So
yeah,
it's a bit easier to dodge in this instance, but I still feel like the timing can be tight, especially while it's still shooting its initial set of bullets and then it sends a second one, then you have to kind of dodge around that.
So you have Kiwi Craze fresh in the mind? Because the five missiles that it shoots in that formation, that's a Kiwi Craze thing.
Disclosed that I didn't get very far in the arcade version, because I was like, I'm done credit feeding. I don't have the patience for this right now, but maybe one day.
This boss shoots homing missiles in the arcade, but I think they're actually easier to deal with in the arcade than they are in the NES version, because it doesn't shoot them in the big wave. It shoots them more or less in a more straight line, and they're easier to deal with. And it's not like they home in on you constantly. They home in a bit. It's not nearly as rough as the NES version in terms of that. But I think it's definitely a more challenging boss than the octopus. It has a wider weak spot because his chest opens up. I think it's a more difficult boss, but it's sort of the same thing.
I would argue for the NES version in Kiwi Korea, it was a bit easier than Rock Octopus, but I think not being bats was a bonus for the NES version.
So, level 4, Straight Cook. Now, this is primarily long diving sections. Are these water segments... I can see where it's going. Are these water segments well-designed to take advantage of your air meter and timer?
Well, Kiwi Craze / New Zealand Story is already a labyrinthine-ish game, so why don't we add that with the labyrinthine aspects while you're underwater? Now it's a case of where are the places where I can get enough water in time while also not getting smacked by bubbles that are occupying a place where I need to regain my air and swimming to where Fifi is.
I bet when you saw those bubbles, you were thinking, oh, that's a good refill for my air.
I just thought they would reach the surface and then pop, but no, they just hang out there and it's miserable.
They are like really tough bubbles. Surprisingly strong bubbles, but yeah. A lot of these segments are definitely based around the limits of your air meter, because Tiki cannot swim fast, and he cannot hold his breath very long, and they kind of know these limits. And trying to navigate through these, especially with these little things bouncing around and different sea life under here, and the sea life is generally not too bad, but it's because you have to hold your breath the whole time, it makes it a bit worse. I think I would have liked maybe one of the last three worlds to be a little less water heavy, but it's definitely a mechanic that they've been building on and building on and building on. And yeah, it's definitely in full force in World 4. The big exception in World 4 is that 4-4 is completely different. Now, 4-4 is a maze of spikes, and it doesn't have a boss. It has a second maze of spikes. So let's talk about 4-4.
Yeah, so thankfully you're no longer underwater, but your reward is that you're in a more technical platforming stage where I don't think 4-4 is as labyrinthine as some stages will be very soon, but it still is relatively maze-like. It's just that the issue with this is now, first of all, getting your vehicle to fly to certain spots when needed, but then also making sure that you dismount on said vehicle while not hitting spikes at the same time, or you jump and then you don't hit spikes at the same time, or you miss your jump and then fall into spikes. So, personally, I actually prefer this over the swimming because I hate swimming that much, but it is frustrating. I guess I prefer the more technical platforming in this game, which is strange because it is a very hovering to dodge things game. Otherwise,
one complaint I'll have about this is hovering balloons between spikes when they're only a block apart. It's a lot easier in Kiwi Craze than it is in the arcade game, because there's more wobble on your balloon in the arcade game, but it's not necessarily easy on the NES as well. So there's a lot of time wasted if you lose a balloon or not.
And sometimes enemies just take a while to respawn. The one time you need them to spawn, they don't.
Yeah, there's definitely that too. But you're right, the 4-4 maze isn't too bad, but it is harrowing and dangerous. The pirate ship, I think, is a bit worse. The pirate ship maze is smaller, but it has some fuckery involved. First of all, what did you think about finding a pirate ship instead of a boss?
It was kind of disappointing, even though I kind of like the weird concept of it being a pirate ship. The boss being, I guess, to go travel this spiky map as a gimmick, but I think I would have preferred a boss at this point, even if I did just experience that in the first half of the stage.
Yeah, I would have liked to board a pirate ship and fight a pirate boss, but it's a small maze, but there is some fuckery involved with this, and this level also introduces, or at least features, It's almost like the donut blocks from Super Mario Brothers 3. These blocks that when you stand on them, they start to descend.
Oh, yeah.
They're not quite the same because they don't, you know, stay there for a minute and then drop, but they just descend when you stand on them.
Oh, and then one of them leads into spikes. I was like, thank you. Yes. I should have seen that coming.
There's three in a row that are over spikes, and you kind of have to climb up and then kind of drop down to them, run across, and jump. One mechanic of Tiki I never mentioned was that if you're falling a distance, you can rapidly press the jump button, the flutter, slow your fall. You don't have the space to do that here, so you just kind of have to try the jump as you land. And I found this a little inconsistent, but that's more than likely just my particular skill at it. But man, you could get spiked really easy at that one part. Most of it's pretty manageable. I thought it was all right. It was an interesting concept. Definitely a good break from the water. I would have preferred a boss, though.
I mean, maybe we should just accept this, because boss 4 probably would have been like some sort of awful water boss in some bizarre fashion, and I don't want to experience that.
We are on to Hammer Springs and Mount Cook. And this is the final world. It splits the world between sort of a volcanic or hot springs kind of area and then an ice area. So the volcanic Hammer Springs, these are heavily maze-like. It's got some hot water or magma on the ground. And it has these, like, turrets that fire rapidly. These are crater turrets. What did you think of these particular levels?
Again, I'm thankful we're not swimming anymore, but this is definitely where it's a lot of jumping, a lot of verticality, and a lot of waiting for those projectiles to go through to time your jumps correctly, which, you know, sometimes you overshoot it and then you hit a projectile, or you make the first jump and then you get hit by the second projectile. So it's really frustrating in that aspect.
This is also a lot of time wasting, because even in 5-1, there's a lot of paths that you could take that are just for fruit, or they just take you around a circle. There's one path you can take, and that's it, right? And if you don't know it and you don't take it, chances are you're going to run the timer down. I think 5-2 is much more cruel, because if there's a maze in the game, it's 5-2. This is a pretty ridiculous maze.
Yeah,
you want to talk about 5-2 a bit?
Yeah, so 5-2 does occasionally have some of those little craters that are projectile shooting, which is less bad as it was in 5-1, but the main issue of 5-2 is that it's a huge level, that is a huge maze, and you have jumps that are pretty tight, so often you will jump a little too high and you will end up on the track you were just on quite some time ago.
Even though I played this level a couple of times between the different versions, or, you know, different similar setups, I guess, this level between the different versions, you know, you kind of don't remember, you know, inherently, unless you've played it quite a few times, which way to go.
Oh, I drew a map, which you probably don't have access to if you were at arcade, unless you were some weird child who, like, brought your notepad with you, and you're like, all right, this is the chart for 5-2.
Yeah, you kind of get a feeling for what it's trying to do after a while. But because there's, like, a lot of very samey-looking paths, it's easy to get tripped up. And it's definitely the most maze-like maze in this maze game, for sure. So you can appreciate it on that grounds. So 5-3 is a huge departure from that level. It's still a maze. It's a different kind of maze. 5-3... it does two things. First of all, if you die, you go back to the beginning of the level. Previously, if you die, you basically start where you died. But 5-3 and 5-4, you go back to the beginning of the level. 5-3 also introduces ice physics. And that's not really a factor in this stage. It's a huge factor in the next one. But it's not really a factor in this one, because this is sort of a balloon maze.
Yeah, 5-3 is just a balloon maze, and it's honestly a relatively easy balloon maze. It's, you kind of get the idea that you're supposed to go to the upper right, and once you realize that where the, like, endpoints are, you kind of easily figure out that it kind of has a in a way, predictable maze pattern.
But yeah, this one's not so bad. But 5-4, the final level, is a bit of an arsehole, in my opinion. But do you have any words on 5-4?
I mean, not as bad as swimming, but you have some very... what's the word I'm looking for? It's really jumpy with its platforming. And then it's also platforming on ice. So occasionally you will... well, I wouldn't say occasionally. I think for most of the stage, I would make a jump. And then in that hesitation where I wasn't sure where to go, I would slide off and then I'd have to start over.
Yeah. See, the big issue with also starting right from the beginning in this level is that it's quite... I wouldn't say taxing, but you only had one ice level for context previous to this. And that wasn't even really an ice level. It was a balloon level. So this is really your introduction and trial by fire to ice. Because, yeah, there's a lot of sliding off into spikes in this one. You kind of have to memorize where to jump. Because if you could just keep jumping on these tiny blocks of ice, it's not really that bad. Because you have more than enough room for Tiki to make these jumps. It's just you have to learn how to stop yourself when there's nothing ahead of you. And you have to kind of know where things are. Like, basically 4 floors high. And the final floor is mostly a bunch of enemies. I strongly recommend getting a UFO. But if not, I think you can fight the Leopard Seal without a balloon on the NES game, but you need a balloon to fight it on the arcade because the floor is lined with spikes. So, talk a little bit about the Leopard Seal boss.
Seeing that the exit was in the upper left, I just got my first vehicle and bolted my way there into the swarm of enemies that kept spawning there. Pretty much, it's the Leopard Seal. He's got a big balloon. He's got some projectiles that are fortunately easy to dodge, and because I guess there aren't spikes on the bottom of the NES version, I just did some easy dodging and shot away, and I was like, oh, that wasn't too bad after all.
Well, he's pretty easy on the arcade as well, even with a bow. You obliterate him with a UFO, but with a bow, it's not so bad. Just because of the arc of its cannon fire or whatever kind of gun he has. If you only have arrows, you might have to go behind him because he'll close in on you. And if he gets right up next to you, then you'll probably get hit. But you can kind of kite him around the room and it's relatively easy to knock him out. And you would think I would complain about an easy final boss, but really 5-4 is a difficult level. And that's sort of a final boss in and of itself because you have to do it in one go. So
I think World 4 was the real final boss, so, you know, it's fine.
That's the end. You rescue Fifi, and then you get the prologue as the ending.
My favorite thing about the NES version is that you rescued Fifi, and in, like, a different colored text, so it kind of stands out, and all the other keyways.
So, we're getting into the final thoughts of the New Zealand story. Have you played any other versions of the New Zealand story this month? And I think for you it was Kiwi Craze. How did Kiwi Craze compare? And I know we talked about it more in the podcast than I intended to, but how did they compare?
Yeah, so Kiwi Craze, again, being the one I actually cleared, and I only played roughly to Roll 2 for both versions of the arcade. I'll say, first of all, maybe it was just the way I play the arcade game. It was very difficult to control, but you kind of mentioned throughout the game discussion that maybe that's just kind of naturally that the arcade game, you just feel a little more slippery in a way. So maybe that was one of my initial difficulties with it, other than it being an arcade game and it's a crowd feeding thing. So I think the NES version, just maybe the controller or just... maybe the way it just mechanically works was a bit easier for me. did end up clearing it with a couple of game overs, but in the end I did clear it. So yeah, I would say it's definitely an easier game, especially the final boss. I don't know if that's really something to really take off points from it. I know that the NES has limitations. And speaking of limitations, I think one of the biggest disappointments of the NES port is just the graphics look kind of not too great. I know it's very difficult to get the rich, colorful graphics of an arcade game to the NES, but I feel like there's just something about them that maybe they just need to do something with their tile sets for the backgrounds that made it very distracting, or just made it look a little more muddier that didn't make it look so great to me. I think another issue is just that with the graphical capabilities of the NES, like spikes are just kind of difficult to see, especially when you're trying to dodge them.
On that point, I found that in World 2, you had a brown background with brown obstacles and brown damaging things, right? So yeah, I can see that.
Yeah, I don't know if there was a better way to balance this. Maybe just make it more of a flat background for Kiwi Craze to really make the front elements pop more, or just style them differently that it wouldn't just be so distracting or so clustered looking, even though the game is very clustered to begin with. But the music was great, though. I think Tim Follin did the music for Kiwi Craze. Am I wrong about that? Did I misread something? Tim and Jeff Follin, yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, that was pretty sweet about it. Yeah, I think just for the arcade game, again, being more powerful, I would probably prefer that just because it looks greater, and then I just like the more variety that you get in that game. Not to say that the port is bad, it's just that I feel like the arcade really shines through. It doesn't feel like a well-translated experience to the NES, even though it still is a decent game there.
There's definitely a loss of some features. For instance, well, the extended system's gone. We already mentioned that you have lives instead. And there's less enemies, and there's less balloons. I think the NES has the iron balloons, the duck balloons, and the the bear balloons. I think it has half the balloons. And it's missing several enemies. Tiki swims really slowly, but it feels excruciatingly slow on the NES, likely the same velocity. There are certain things about the NES experience I personally found easier, and some things I found more difficult. I found the platforming generally a bit easier, and I found navigating balloons through tight spaces generally easier. And I don't know if that's because the NES maybe operates on a bit more of a grid than the arcade does or not. I don't know the technical bias behind that, or if it's just a qualitative bias on my part. So I don't know if it's empirical or just something I felt. I think Kiwi Craze is definitely, it's not up to snuff of the arcade, but it's definitely a good game. I do think that the palette could be a bit more differentiated, like you said, but I think it's definitely a good game. And but as we talked about, losing a lot of the features and enemies from the arcade game, it's no question that the arcade game's it's a more solid choice. And I was personally surprised that the New Zealand story wasn't on arcade archives or anything like that, because I think it was on Tidal Legends, but it's definitely a game that's sort of been a bit forgotten. And this is a game that they had the New Zealand story Revolution out about, and that game, I didn't play it this month, but I watched a bit of it, and I did play it, back in the day when I got interested in the series. It's one of these DS games that added touch screen stuff to it just because it's a DS game. I thought it was fun, and it's a good introduction to the New Zealand story as well. Yeah. I haven't played any of the home computer, the Spectrum, or Amiga, or Mega Drive versions of the game, but I think they're probably all based. Well, they're not all based on the Japanese version, but most of them are. So I think it's
for the most part, the predominant releases are the NES release and the arcade initial. Also, it's interesting there was never a Famicom release. I was kind of curious about that. I don't think it was ever released in that format there.
I don't know if there's a PAL release of Kiwi Craze. A Kiwi Craze is a terrible name as well, but It's also during a precarious situation because the New Zealand story, I don't know how big it was in arcades over here, but it's also not a attention-grabbing name for like a mainstream audience. Even though it's a very cute game and all that, so I'm sure it would have a lot of word of mouth on it. And we pretty well rented everything back in the day. I think the New Zealand story in general is it's a pretty decent game. And if you kind of know the Japanese level set, a lot of these home versions will probably be fun. But I can't speak with any authority on which is the best or which is the worst. But you can't, like, Kiwi Craze, as we mentioned, it's not a perfect version, but if you can find it on the NES, it's a lot of fun. I picked up a copy of it when I saw it, and I don't regret that. Kind of talked a little bit about the difficulty of this game throughout the podcast, but where do you think this falls in terms of difficulty?
So it's hard to say because the NES, as we just mentioned, is a lot easier. And you don't really find a lot of 1-ups in the game, or at least I didn't find a lot of 1-ups because I've dealt with enough mazes.
I'd say there was harder parts and there was easier parts.
Also, if you want to try the warping method, you could do that. That's still an option in the NES version. I don't know if there are multiple Heaven versions because I didn't actually check for all of them. But still, like we said, it's an interesting aspect of that game. The arcade version, I feel like I would just need to give another try, especially after I cleared the whole game. I know more what to expect, and I mean, it was mostly a control thing when I tried the arcade versions. I don't know. I really have to sit down and get a feel for it. So, NES version, easy, but still has its tough points. Arcade game, I mean, it's hard to rate an arcade game sometimes because they really do like those quarters back then.
Yeah, you were talking about credit feeding, but it's, I mean, it isn't arcade.
I'm sure it's doable. I'm just bad, so.
I mean, that's the intended way to play it, is the credit feeding, right? But, no, it's,
I'm sure people out there have, like, a 1cc clear. That's just not me right now.
Well, to be honest, when I played the more difficult level set, I did a lot better than when I played the easier level set. And that's just out of familiarity with the game at that point, because I'd played it twice before, the NES version and the Japanese original version, right? So when I played the world new set, there's points where I died because of the more harsh enemies that were popping up. But I generally adapted to situations much more quickly, and it's just a familiarity thing. And that's the case with a lot of these arcade games. Yes, the New Zealand story is definitely going to take quarters out of you. And a lot of these mazes are kind of designed like that. You're going to go to the bottom of this shaft and you have to climb all the way back up. Well, that's going to run down your timer.
I can just imagine myself now playing the arcade version, and I'm in World 5 and I just jump a little too high in 5-2 and I'm back to that old path again. It's like, oh yeah.
I'm sure it was frustrating, but I think the game was compelling enough and maybe different enough from its contemporaries at the time that I think people would want to get to the end. And for things like the warps, it's probably one of these collaborative information building that kind of happened back then. Probably had people leaving notes on arcade machines and stuff, right? Definitely a difficult game, but I think that the New Zealand story becomes a lot more manageable with experience. It's just sometimes when you're dying again and again and again, that can become daunting because the game gives no fucks, right? It's at points of it. It's like,
it's a prickish game.
Yeah, it's like,
with swimming.
With swimming. It gives no fucks at times, and it's like, you have to adapt or die. And that's the case for a lot of old arcade games. It's a bit more harsh than maybe a self-contained screen, like a Don Doko Don or a Bubble Bobble, although Bubble Bobble is quite harsh in its own ways at times. And Don Doko Don is quite harsh in its own ways at times, but they're one-screen games. So that's sort of the difference there. You have kind of a more salient picture of progress when you see your characters going from screen to screen to screen. You know you're making progress, and you know you're not going to go back to the beginning of these level sets when you put the quarter in. Do you have any final thoughts on the New Zealand story?
Well, I cleared all of Kiwi Craze, and you know, I didn't dislike it. So yeah, I mean,
No.
overall, it was still a pleasant game and still really cute. And clearing Kiwi Craze gave me the motivation. I mean, also, I need to get the motivation just loaded up, but the motivation to actually sit down and clear maybe at least the New Zealand story, Japanese edition. And if I like that enough, maybe I'll try a world as well. But you know, from the two worlds I experienced from the arcade version, I mean, I did like how cute it looked. I really like the graphical color palette of it. It looks really fun. Of course, it has some irritating points to it, but overall, it was a fun game.
Yeah, and there's not really a long-winded final thoughts to have about the New Zealand story. It's a fun game. It's difficult, but it is accessible. And it's mostly self-explanatory what you have to do to get through it. It's a five-world game. It could take you as long as you put into it to get through it. It's cute, it's fun. And if you have the opportunity to play the New Zealand story, I think it's a fun one to go through personally. This has been the Arrowcast for February 2022, featuring the New Zealand story and a little bit of Kiwi craze. Chris, where can we reach you if we'd like to?
You can reach me at twitter.com/Karasu, CawRasu.
And where can we reach Arrow?
You can reach Agro, who I've been worried about. She's getting these balloons. I hope she doesn't have to swim or anything. At twitter.com/AgroCast, AGROCAST.
And you can reach me at twitter.com/Matazoic, MATTOZOYC. It's like the Mesozoic era, except the dinosaurs are better. And the website's the same, matazoic.com. Chris, what can we look forward to in March?
Yeah, we're gonna visit a franchise that we actually have not touched yet in this podcast. A series that I am not very familiar with because I've only cleared about 2 to 3 games. So we'll be revisiting a Sonic CD.
Yeah, we're gonna do it to us and visit the Sonic Underground and play Sonic CD. It'll be good times.
Until then, cheers.
Cheers.